You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
And Tracy, I needed that music. I'm dancing in my chair again.
I'm not going to lie. I was kind of bopping it too. And I got to say, given the events of this week, particularly from Wednesday beyond, I feel like I'm 15 pounds skinnier, 2 feet taller. I'm fairly sure that I now hail from Themyscira and have like powers and stuff. I'm just saying that I feel like a woman transformed, and I'm sure that no one listening to this podcast has even the remotest reason of why that could possibly be, let alone any nationwide reason why that possibly could be.
I'll just throw it out there. We're recording on Saturday, January 23rd, and it's been literally like a week since the President of the United States has called someone stupid on Twitter.
Yeah.
Like, it hasn't happened. I don't get it. I feel like we've slipped into a different, like, we're in an alternate reality now. Either that, or the television show, the reality show that was America, has moved on to a new season, and they've replaced.
New showrunner. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Doctor Who. They've replaced the president and he regenerated.
And yeah.
There's now a new actor.
This is the Biden regeneration. And naturally, the fans are like, well, it's still an old white guy, but you know. And so I think that's a fair critique. And, you know, they're really working on it. The writer's room has been thinking really carefully about how to sort of like widen the net.
There was a lot of talk about Idris Elba. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. So you may be wondering, folks, who is generously providing us a laugh track in the background. And I must say that when our bop was playing, our intro music, it's gritty, it's but upbeat at the same time, and it's very lively, and it feels very Laurel K. Hamilton to me. It feels very Anita Blake. So Laurel, how are you?
Well, thank you, and I agree. I was actually dancing in my chair to the music too. I am doing well today on this. It's bright and sunny, though cold here. And yes, everybody has seemed to leave a psychic sigh of relief, and the energy did get better overall in the ether.
Yeah,
recently.
It's a thing. I know it's not the most articulate framing, but there's been something about the last 4 years generally for me, but particularly like this last month, like the last 3 weeks, that I think have sort of drained out all of my ability to sophisticatedly articulate my emotional and psychological states. It's just like, there's nobody home anymore. I don't have this capacity. I just need something to change so that I can begin the process of transforming back into a functional human.
It is like we have all been on some kind of tread. We are all being tested together and put through some kind of emotional upheaval this year. We're all in this together, and I just hope we all remember that we are all in this together.
Yeah, yeah, no lie. So how are things down in St. Louis is home for you, correct?
Yes, it is.
How are things down where you are?
Quiet, actually, knock on wood.
Yeah.
It's been, I mean, oh, you know, it's been quiet, and weirdly, since I have a home office, for me, things haven't changed as much or as drastically as they have for other people. And one of the reasons I wanted to do the new book we're going to be talking about, Raphael, is I had so many people when Sucker Punch came out this summer that they were going, "Oh, thank God, thank you, you gave me a place to escape to." And I thought, okay. And I talked to my publisher, and I said, I want to get another story out as soon as I can.
And they said, nobody wants a 28th Anita. Like, no, they said, here's a big pile of money. Let's do it, right?
Something like that. Because so many people, I mean, all of us have found books and movies. And I don't think any of us realized how much we missed just going to the store without worrying about it, just simple errands and everything. You know, it you don't realize how much socialization you get in everyday life until it's not there.
Yeah.
So, so what can I do? What can I do to make things better? I didn't have the magic wand, you know, that equipment is not in my bag. So I thought, well, I can write faster. I can write more, and I can share more places for people to escape to, and some adventure that isn't going to endanger them. And so that's what I did, because when there's nothing else left, writers write. It's what we do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I had had the magic wand to make everything magically better, I'd have done that instead, but it was not no within doubt. My powers.
You know, it's funny because you talked about things didn't change as much for you, obviously, because you work from a home office. I think to your point, the writers who have struggled are the ones who go to coffee shops.
Oh my God. Because you can't. It was in the App Store, but it went away because somebody said it was there, and whoever took it out sooner. But it was an app that just had the sounds of a coffee shop.
Yeah.
And they just missed the boat, because this yeah. would have been a brilliant sound app for all those writers.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been the same as going to a coffee shop and interacting and everything, but it would have helped. I've actually, some years back, there have been a few times that I call it my office gets haunted. And before my daughter, before I had my daughter, I could, you know, throw everything in the car. And I wrote a great deal of some of my books, at different restaurants and, places like that. Panera, before they painted their walls a different color, was a big one for me.
What happened to the walls?
Did the paint mess you up?
Well, actually, yes. It used to be kind of a soothing green, and then they changed to this burnt kind of orange.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because the first room, my room as a child was painted pale blue. So I don't know if that is why I write better with that. Or if, you know, I studied up on color when I realized that there was a shop in California that sold telescopes. And my first husband was into that. And I liked looking at the stars, but the technology, I didn't really want to sit there for 2 hours talking technology of telescopes with anyone. So I would find a corner of the shop, and I had my writer's notebook, because that was before smartphones. And I would make copious notes on whatever I was writing, and the shop was painted pale green. I work better surrounded by pale blue or pale green walls. If you take me to a store, if the walls are that either of those two colors, I suddenly write better. I will suddenly get better ideas. And I think writers should really pay attention to that, because you may be more sensitive to colors and write better around certain colors of walls. And once I realized how much that impacted me, like literally, I stopped being able to write at Panera when they changed their wall color. And I thought, well, okay.
That's really interesting. I also think it's interesting that you found it difficult to focus on telescopes.
Oh, Lord.
Oh.
I'm going to rescue us from that pun. So my day job, Laurel, as the listeners already know, is that I'm a teacher, and I have the best job in the world because I get to teach science fiction and fantasy literature and creative writing.
Congratulations.
I know, right? Like, they pay me for this. Please, somebody don't tip them off. it's gonna ruin my gig. But one of the theory of mind things, which is true and supported by research, and I talk to my students about, because we're at a kind of goofy high school environment, so they all take SAT and ACT at some point or another, is if you were to study for an exam wearing a certain set of clothes, like say your comfy sweatshirt and your pajama bottoms or whatever, there is a marked and traceable improvement to scores taken where if you were to study over a period of time wearing those clothes in your room, chilling, doing whatever it is you do, if you can replicate those conditions to the greatest extent possible by wearing those same clothes again, please wash them, when you go to take that test later, there can be as much as a 15% improvement in overall retention of information and scores. And so what your experience that you're describing there as a writer is completely backed up by actual educational research about how the brain works.
Well, good to know. The other, there's another study for tests that if you are chewing a particular kind of gum, if you're drinking a particular thing, if you have a peppermint, you can purposely pick a like a hard candy. Yeah. Some professors don't like to hear you chew gum, and you can't often take a drink in. But if you have put a piece of hard candy in your mouth and you associate that with your studying for the test, yeah, it also will raise your score.
Yeah, it's about kind of, you kind of train, we train ourselves to sort of habituate to certain environments, and we, yes, can train ourselves positively or negatively. And certainly something a lot of writers we've had on in the last 6 or 8 months have talked about is the way that the current, they've had to fight against being sort of negatively habituated in the current environment. Like there have been disruptions for some of them to how they do their work or how they interact with their fans, or, you know, for some of them who are launching their first book, like farewell, the whole idea of making a bookstore appearance.
My heart really goes out to anybody that launched their first book this year. But, you know, it has disrupted me. I mean, Sucker Punch had just gone to edits to New York. And so on my end, things hadn't changed, but my editor, all my publishing house, suddenly they're in New York. So their building is locked down. They can't go to work. And it changed a great deal on their end. And, thank God for technology, because we were able to do it. But it was the most unusual edit I've ever gone through. Very, very interesting. And it was much, even though the technology was there, because I think we were all thrown off our rhythm. So that was really hard. It was kind of, we had to figure out how to do this differently. We did. And Sucker Punch was great. And it went really well. And I was very glad to get it out this summer. But yeah, no signings, no travel, no tour. And, you know, I tried to do stuff online, and I was going to read to everybody because everybody said that me reading to them is very soothing. But what I found is reading with video, the days that I did video reading to the fans, I didn't do any writing because I'm a writer. I'm not an actress. I'm not a voice actress even. So I found it very stressful performance-wise to read and be filmed and know it's out there forever, like we were talking about. And it weirded me out. So I hope to get better at that. But it was very interesting how much energy it took for me to do that, to do video. I may try to do some kind of podcast reading and see if the fans are okay with that and see if that's less stressful for me.
Yeah. That's something I've heard before, and you know, I've experienced it myself, you know, trying to do video instead of audio, because I've been in audio for 10 years now. And then I switched in the early part of 2020. I started doing these little video segments for our patrons. And that actually did become very, very stressful. What I'm curious about is when you had that conversation that you said, I want to put out another book this year.
Yeah.
How did that go over? Because that's not something usually you know, the publishers like to try to do. You know, they've got that 18-month cycle that they work with.
Well, my editor and I, you know, I clued my agent first. She and I have had this talk that she says, please let me know what's happening before you talk to anybody else.
Don't go rogue.
Yes. And so I told her what I was proposing. And her concern, of course, was, can you do it? Because I have another book coming out this summer, which when this interview is done, I will be going back to editing on that, because it's come back from my editor and we're doing it again. And she says, will this be too much? And I do have a tendency sometimes to overschedule myself. I've learned not to agree to deadlines if I am at the end of a book, because at the end of the book, it writes really fast. It writes really fast for me, and I'm in the groove, and the muse is running, and I'm just really in the zone, and I go, of course I can do it. And then I sober up, and I go, oh my God, what did I do? And so I've learned to not make deadlines at the end of a book. But after talking to so many of my fans, and I said, well, you know, I want to be just tell Raphael. Now, it's still first-person narration with Anita's viewpoint. It always will be. I'm a first-person narrator. So I, you know, it's always going to have to, she's the camera for me on the world. But I really, really loved finally being able to talk about Raphael in more detail and about his background and about the culture of the were-rats of the Roder, because they were the only shapeshifters in the first book. Guilty Pleasures has only the were-rats. You don't see anybody else on stage, any of the other shapeshifters. And so Raphael's been with me from the beginning. And now finally, the 28th book, he gets more center stage. And so I went to them, and it's Year of the Rat. It's Chinese. It's Chinese New Year. It turned, last year was Year of the Rat. And according to Chinese astrology, it is still Year of the Rat. Well, it has not
Lunar
changed.
New Year isn't until February. Yeah.
Right. So Raphael is okay, we'll just squeak in. And I did mean that pun. we'll just come in at the end of the year. So when people were going, oh my God, you know, 2020, it hasn't gotten any better. It's 2021. It's not changed yet. So we still start fresh in February. But I wanted to do it Year of the Rat. I thought, well, if I'm going to do an extra book, it needs to be Raphael. It needs to be the were-rats. And, this sounds really weird, but I sit down with my characters and I will talk. I will do like a free form, just sit there and type at the computer and go, okay, talk to me. And I said, okay, Raphael, I went to him first. I said, do you have a story? What do you want to say? And I just type. And if he had not spoken up, I was going to go to Claudia and see if Claudia wanted to be center stage, because she also is a were-rat, and she has not been with me the whole time, but she is one of the most requested of the female characters to come and have more of her story told in the front. So Raphael talked to me and came up with some ideas, and some notes I already knew about his background, some I didn't, but it all came together. I could not have written this story and done the were-rats justice any earlier, I don't think. And part of that is that their culture is really, really influenced by the fact that I do Filipino martial arts. And if you look at the history of the Philippines, the Spanish influence in the Philippines, really, you can't do the history of the Philippines without talking about the Spanish. And it's just too intertwined. And the more history I looked at, the more I went, okay, this is much more complicated than I thought, which is always the case if you look at real history. And I thought, now, let me just say, there was no way to get everything I researched in one book. It ain't happening. So, you know, but I enjoyed the world building and the culture so much that I really do want to do more with the Roder and more with the were-rats, because I had so much research I didn't get to put on paper. And the fact that I am a fifth level in Kali, which is the Filipino martial arts that uses weaponry, which is sticks, knives, or swords. Mm-hmm. If I hadn't had that background, I think the fight scenes wouldn't have been as good. And I was so worried about the fight scenes that I actually ran them by my instructor. I said, will you do me the favor and please read the fight scenes to make sure I haven't screwed up? Because I'm going, you know, yes, I know how to do this, but it's different when it's in writing. You can't yeah. save it. You can't yeah. practice it again. It's got to be there. And I've only been doing this, I think I'm over 3 years, so I'm on my fourth year. So if I hadn't done this, I wouldn't have been able to do, I wouldn't have known where to go with the research. Mm-hmm. And it would have been a lesser book. So I am very glad that I waited.
It sounds like a sort of perfect confluence of something that was in your heart and your desire to do. And clearly you're really trying to be responsive to your readers on so many levels of like, what characters would they love to see more of? And what do they in their hearts need? And also just the training that you've done and the research that you've done, it seems like it was sort of a perfect storm. How it
yes.
kind of came together.
Yes. One of the interesting things that's come out since I announced the book, and I took a picture of the books I've used for research, and a lot of them were on Filipino culture. And I had so many people that are Filipino or have that in their background somewhere that are just so happy that they will be represented. And now, of course, I'm nervous that I won't represent them well enough.
Right.
But one of the interesting things is, you know, from the very beginning, and I did this without, I didn't sit there and go, well, I have to be inclusive, because this is back in the late 80s. People weren't talking about that. But from the very beginning, we are not just one flavor. We mm-hmm. come in many, many forms. And I, you know, Anita chose her ethnicity. She's biracial. And I don't know if that's the term everyone's using now. I can't keep up with the vocabulary. But people want to be represented. They want to read something and see somebody that they can feel like they have more in common with.
What I was going to say is, one of the things that calls to mind for me is, since the first Anita Blake book was published, unless I'm wrong, but I'm recalling it, 1993, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So from 1993 to now, 2021, that's a pretty long runway. And in the course of that series development, your development as a writer, the world itself has changed a ton.
Oh my God.
And I have to imagine that has had an impact in a variety of ways on the choices that you're making as a writer, whether it's from the details of like, oh crap, now everybody has a smartphone, so it's going to be harder to isolate characters and situations and deny them information or things like that, to, you know, that sort of quotidian stuff, to like much higher level sorts of things, like talking about how we place difference and how we place culture within texts and things. I'm sort of wondering, like, what do you find yourself really consciously having to do differently now writing Anita Blake in 2021 versus writing Anita Blake in 1993?
Well, I'll address the technology first, because I started where there were pagers. Pagers was big technology. And if you had cell phones were these huge blocks that almost nobody had.
Yeah.
So at one point in the series, I just had to finally decide to update the tech without explaining, without having the time pass. And we just had modern tech. We went one book where we hadn't talked about it. Then we suddenly had smartphones, and I just went ahead with it. There have been a couple of long running mystery series that have done the same thing, that have updated. John D. McDonald, the Travis McGee series, he started out, is a vet of one war, and he got updated to mm-hmm. be a vet of another. And so it's pretty traditional in some long running mystery series that eventually you just update and you don't explain. Mm-hmm. And that's what I finally had to do with the technology. But you're right. Most of the so many classic mysteries will not work now with the modern technology. You can't, you know, I'm sorry. You can reach anybody anywhere unless, and more and more every year. So yes, totally, totally had to address that. The biggest thing is, one of the biggest things I have had to watch is inadvertent body shaming.
Oh,
and what do I mean by that? Well, in one of the early books, I said any woman below a size, I can't remember what I picked, is just a boy with breasts. And it was an Anita quip, one of the early books, first three books, I think. And I wish I hadn't said that. I would take that back if I could, but it's in print, because I have seen now... I've seen both our girlfriend and my sister go through, they're very small, mm-hmm. and naturally so. And I've seen people be so mean to them because they're thin, naturally thin. And I watched my sister go through eating disorder mm-hmm. and with her. And so in another book, I decided I would try to go the other way. And I would say, you know, that I had her, and this is true. And junior high was like a size 11, which is different size than 11 is today, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then I grew as short as I am. Yes, I did grow. I swear. And then people go, well, 11's not big. You cannot win this. Yeah. There is no win here. So I have really stopped. No quips, no judgments. I will mention no sizes, nada, nothing. So that was an interesting thing. As a woman, I mean, you in one of the books, I say she's gained 5 pounds, and then you can't say that anymore. You have to be so, you can't quip that. In your head, you can say what you want. On paper, not so much.
Times change, attitudes change, you know, and what is and isn't, you know, considered good or polite, or I mean, all those things change.
And you know not to do one thing, and then you inadvertently do something else, and mm-hmm. it just so technology, talking about body shape, our sizes, and lucky for me, I've always been diverse. I don't know why, it just seemed natural to just have, you know, not everybody looks the same.
I think the fact that you're using a sort of like a kind of funhouse mirror version of St. Louis as we know it as your backdrop is useful, because although I think a lot of people who live outside of the Midwest probably don't think of St. Louis very much at all, the reality of it is someone goes to St. Louis who's never been there before, they might be surprised by how polyglot it is and how sort of ethnically and socially complex a space it is.
Yeah. Yes. Most people don't think of St. Louis. Actually, when the books first came out, the series first came out, I had one review. I had two different reviews, and I can't remember who, but one review said it was set in New Orleans. And I'm going, no. And I thought, well, all right, I'll give you that. It had vampires in it, so they thought Anne Rice, so sure. New Orleans. Okay, fine. Both towns were settled by the French first, so, you know, okay, fine.
Round up.
But another one said it was set in New York, and I'm going, damn it, there are more cities. There are more cities in the world than...
No, vampires only get two. Two cities for you vampires in America.
You would think, talking to people, that there are only three cities in all of the United States. There's New mm-hmm. York, there's Chicago, and then there's Los Angeles, and no, but nothing else exists.
You know, it's kind of funny, because when I was shopping my book around my urban fantasy, and trying to get agents and people interested in it, the character was born in Chicago, but the story is set in Denver. And I had people telling me, well, you can't do anything in Chicago because Butcher owns that. So you can't do anything there. And you can't really do anything with Denver because Carrie Vaughn owns Denver. What do you mean they own it?
I would love to own a city, actually, but that's really not how this works.
I actually told Carrie that and she laughed her ass off.
You know, I didn't know people were being told they couldn't use cities because somebody else was there. Yeah. That's interesting.
Go ask your agent if you own St. Louis. This could be important for merchandising purposes. I'm just saying, like... you need to get in touch with the mayor. They may owe you.
Yeah. Right. okay. I'll think about that. But that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous because there's so many series of different kinds set in so many different cities that's ridiculous.
It's publishing. It's publishing. What do you expect? Yeah.
Well, when I was first marketing the Anita series, it's before there was urban fantasy, before there was paranormal. So I literally had one rejection that said that the market for vampire books, the bottom has dropped out of the market for vampire books. Vampire book is dead. And, you know, they forgot. Vampire, like all good monsters, never really dies. But but I ran into some of that as well back then, but it was for different reasons. Mm-hmm. So there's always some idea that people get in their heads when they're looking at new authors and new series about where you can set something and how it's going to be marketed.
And Laurel, forgive me, have you been to the Pikes Peak Writers Conference?
I was. I went.
I thought so.
I went 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Three or four years.
I can't remember if I was there when you were there or not, because I was big with that organization for many, many years and doing a lot and volunteering and teaching and all kinds of stuff. But one of the things that we always talked about there is don't write one book and then, you know, just try to sell that book. Just keep writing. Write as many books as you can. Write all your, like, just have stuff, because you're always going to run into that thing where someone goes, this is really good. It's really well written. You've proven that you can write a good story. Unfortunately, no one's buying this right now. Do you happen to have something about this?
Yeah. And it's really true. I mean, I wrote, my first novel was Nightseer. It was Elves, Dwarves, and Dragons. Very much Robert E. Howard meets Tolkien. And unfortunately, the bottom dropped out of the fantasy market about the time I was published. And so they didn't want the sequel. And I remember I went from being the elation of having my first book published to thinking my career was dead in the water before it began. I ended up doing a Star Trek book in the meantime, trying to make money. So I got to torture Picard before he was tortured on film in the series. But then one of the reasons that Anita exists is the bottom had dropped out of the fantasy market. Nobody wanted fantasy. My fantasy voice, the book is good, but it's not unique enough. I had a short story featuring Anita Blake, and it was set in a world, Those Who Seek Forgiveness. It's in my short story collection called Strange Candy. That was the first thing. It's zombies. There are no vampires in it. And I had gotten the most positive rejection slips for that story. They loved it, but didn't know what to do with it. And I should have known it would be hard to market because of that. But I looked at that story, at all my stories, all the stuff that I had in my, that hadn't been sold, I thought, this I could do, this seems like a big enough world. I think I can do a book in this. And I have to do something. I had to write something. So I wrote the first book in the series. And there was nothing else out there like that. So interestingly, I wanted to see if it worked. And there was a local science fiction convention at that time called Name That Con. And I went there, and one of Melinda Snodgrass, who was writing for Star Trek Next Generation on the show, she had a reading that day. And she ended up not being able to come. So they put me in the room for Melinda Snodgrass. And no one knew who I was. No one knew what I looked like, and they didn't know what she looked like either. So I am a first-time writer. I have like 2 short stories out, maybe, and I am getting a packed room waiting for me to read. And I thought, what the heck is going on? But, you know, never look a gift horse in the mouth.
Yep.
And so I started to read Guilty Pleasures to this room of people waiting for Star Trek. And they were quiet. They listened. And when people would open the door, they would then come in. And the room was standing room only by the time I finished my hour of reading, which was about 70 pages, I think I was able to read. By the time I finished, and then the room was quiet. And then I went, oh God, they hate it. And then they applauded. And I went, yes, yes, okay, I'm right. I'm on the track. And they said, oh, when is this going to be out? And I thought, I didn't tell the room, but I had read them what I'd written at that point. That was it. And but it
that's a good question. I don't know.
And it gave me this. It really buoyed me up enough to go home and go, no, I am right. This is different, but people like it. It would take over 2 years to sell the first Anita Blake novel because nobody knew what to do with it. Marketing. The mystery houses thought it was science fiction. Science fiction houses thought it was horror. The horror places thought, you know, maybe it was mystery. I got some of the nicest rejections. Some places even recommended other editors, other houses. Because when you're going ahead of the curve, sometimes being out in front is really hard because nobody else has done it. You're cutting your way through the jungle. But as a writer finding your own voice, finding something so unique to you is really how you make your mark. It's how you find your voice, by going ahead of the pack, by not following the trends. Because as you know, especially in traditional publishing, if you look on the shelves at what's trending and selling now, by the time you write your book and they put it out, that trend will be gone.
Yep.
So, you know, find what moves your heart. But I tell writers, I mean, if my first series had sold, I might never have written Anita, but it didn't sell, and I needed something else. So I went through my old short stories and found this. So from your greatest, you know, one of your greatest disappointments, you can come out, rise like do the whole Phoenix thing, and suddenly you're doing better than you ever dreamt, is your career. But you have to find something that interests you. That's,
you know, it's funny. Speaking of Pikes Peak writers, did M.B. Partlow, does that name ring a bell with you?
I am really bad with names.
Okay. So M.B. was part of Pikes Peak writers for many, many years. And she wrote a book that I absolutely adore that has never been published. I feel like it's what you're talking about. It's like they don't really know what to do with it.
Yeah.
But boy, I wish that that book could get published. And I don't think she'll kill, well, she's going to kill me no matter what, but just for talking about it on air. But I don't think she'll kill me for telling the premise. It's a woman who discovers that her hot flashes are opening portals to hell.
That's hilarious.
It is a hilarious book. I actually pushed her a few years ago to try again to get it published, and she did. And I don't think anybody bid at the time. But I absolutely adore that book. It is hilarious. It had me laughing throughout the whole thing. It's what you're talking about, right? It's just write something that means something to you. And she wrote that, and it was wonderful.
And that's the thing. You have to find something that really moves you. But you do run the risk. You do run the risk, because it took over 2 years. I had over 200 rejection slips on Guilty Pleasures by the time it sold. Now, that was before everybody bought everybody, and all the publishing houses have conglomed into each other. So there were more houses to send to. But every rejection slip was just, that person doesn't want it, not that nobody wants it. Mm-hmm. And you have to really, so many writers go to self-publishing, and self-publishing has really changed. You know, decades ago, if you self-published, then no regular publishing house would touch you, and you couldn't make money and everything. But of course, that's very different now. But one of the things that I find is when people say they've gone to self-publishing because they were rejected, I'm not saying your friend. I'm sure she has tried. Pikes Peak is very professional. It was really a great thing. I had a great time. So many people, when I asked them why they went to self-publishing, they say rejection. I have yet to have anybody that has had even 5 rejection slips on something before they gave up and self-published. And if you want to hear me chew the scenery, that will make me chew the scenery. And as I tell the story, and I go, if I were you, then there would have been no Anita Blake, because back then self-publishing was like the kiss of death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so rejection, you know, it feels very personal, but rejection of your manuscripts is like rejection for dating. That one person doesn't want you, but there are others that do. Not everybody likes, you know, chocolate fudge ripple, but somebody out there does. You've just got to find that person. And you shouldn't let anything else discourage you from that. I am very lucky, though. I wrote what I wanted to write, and there was an audience. And the fact that this is the 28th book in one series, I'm flabbergasted, because my first novel was supposed to be 1 of 4, and it was 1, and they didn't want the second one. So I remember when I first sold Anita, and the first one was for 3 books, and I signed that contract. I went, at least there'll be 3 of them. And now here we are at 28. And going back to your question, because I do remember there was one in there, that my editor once, and agent, you know, can you do this? And I said, yes, I can. And once I assured them that that I could meet the deadlines and everything. And I wanted to come out in Year of the Rat. Once we all got our ducks in a row, then they were happy to have me. And one of the things I said, I pointed out that self-publishing, writers that are making a career and a living at self-publishing, I said they bring out books much more often. And yeah. I think that the audience has changed. I think yeah. that the audience and how to build an audience has changed because of that. So I actually think that when I first started Anita, I believed then that you needed at least 2 books a year if you could manage it to build your audience. And I did that. I did that for a number of years. And then when I had the Meredith Gentry series, and they were with 2 different publishing houses at that time. It was before Penguin Putnam merged and be with Random House, so and became Penguin Random House. So I did 2 books a year because I had 2 publishers, and having 2 separate publishers is like dating 2 men. Even if they know about each other, they don't want to share. So I did 2 books a year for a long, long time. And I think that the only way to really grow your audience is to have content out there more often than traditionally publishing thinks you need it.
Yep. Now, I apologize for being the heavy, but we're actually running out of time. So I'm gonna have to unfortunately get us to start wrapping this up. I don't even think we have time for picks of the week. We've had just such a wonderful conversation. I think we're at the point where we're gonna have to start wrapping this up, Tracy.
I think you're probably right. Can we let Laurel do her picks at least? Because I know she had some. So let's since Laurel's been giving us a lot of good stuff here. Let's finish with some more good stuff from Laurel.
Picks of the week. Okay, things that have been keeping me sane and happy. Our family has found the Great British Baking Show, which is just so strangely relaxing. And I think baking has been a salvation for a lot of people. My husband has gone back to baking and has been making some wonderful things here. Then the other thing is the Terry Pratchett Discworld books. I had read a few of them, but it is irreverent and funny and touching and smart. And just, it just seems to cleanse the soul to read those books from Sir Terry.
Yep. I think a lot of people would agree with you on that.
My students are continuing the intergenerational love of Terry Pratchett. And they like to describe his work as wholesome, which I think is an interesting word, but I think it also falls a little bit short of acknowledging, like its depth as well. Those are great picks.
Wholesome?
Yeah.
It depends on the book. It depends on the book. Some of it gets very nitty gritty.
Yeah, wholesome is the new teenage word for it makes me feel warm and fuzzy. And so they use it in a very not nuanced way. So like if they see a video of a cat riding on the back of a monkey or something, they'll call that wholesome. So
wholesome is in the middle of changing its meaning as a word.
It is very one thing I will say that teaching teenagers has given me is a sort of I'm riding shotgun to the transition of the language, and it's an interesting ride, I gotta say.
Do I have time to say one of my favorite transition words?
I want to hear it. Yep.
Okay. Back in the 30s, if you read mysteries, somebody could say exclaim, and they could say he ejaculated that.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And then of course now it has only very specific sexual meaning. But it's just funny. You read some of the early novels and they just use it for language, for when you're startled. And reading it there and then reading it now, it's just going, huh, that's fun.
Yeah.
I love that wholesome is becoming something else.
Even, going into the 60s, my favorite band of all time is the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And, they use the phrase, when I'm home, you're home making me feel good and everything, but they say gay, right?
Yes.
I feel gay. Well, that's got a completely different meaning, right? And not long after that, really, it ended up having a completely different meaning.
Yeah. You can't use that for happy anymore because it has other connotations. I love how language grows and changes though.
Yes. Especially English, we're just nuts. But, so the book is Raphael.
It's out February 9th. Yeah.
Out February 9th. Laura, why don't you tell people where they can find you online, like your website, your social media, and obviously, you know, where they can find the book.
I am Laurel K. Hamilton. My website is LKH at LaurelKHamilton.com. I'm looking at my techie husband going, wait. On Twitter, I am LK Hamilton. My understanding is I'm my whole name on both Instagram and on Facebook.
Okay.
So my website is myname.com and then LK Hamilton on Twitter. I'm sitting here going, official, I'm wrong. Of course I'm wrong. Official _ LK Hamilton, which is Instagram.
Okay. That is something that people do. They do the official.
Yes. You don't want any of those wannabe LK Hamiltons out there.
Strangely enough, the reason I'm LK Hamilton on Twitter is because somebody else had already gotten my name and they wanted me to pay them for it.
Yep.
That is the thing that happens. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Also used to happen with websites.
It did. But thank you so much. I know we all need to go. Thank you so much for having me here, Tracy and Patrick. It's been fun.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Yeah. We appreciate it. So everybody go, and you can probably pre-order the book now and then have it delivered and have it right there, you know, to start reading it on the 9th.
Sorry, you're right. Raphael is available at all the bookstores and on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I'm signing copies for Left Bank Books here in St. Louis. And, you know, so it's fantastic. Everywhere out there.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on, Laurel.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Hey, we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Functional Nerds Podcast. If you're looking for other great podcasts to listen to, I recommend Beyond the Trope. They premiere new nerdy episodes every week. Giles and Michelle have piled up over 7 years worth of interviews with best-selling authors, award-winning actors, and other leaders in the creative community. And even though, I mean, they've sincerely disappointed me by not coordinating a meet and greet with every dog they know, their Patreon supporters and fans love them for keeping their weekly episodes short, sweet, and full of laughs. Check them out over at beyondthetrope.com. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a backer of the show over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We have all new levels with some fantastic rewards like access to our patrons-only Facebook group, exclusive extra shows and content like the new video podcast, Just 10 Minutes, book giveaways, yep, we're giving away books, and even short story critiques provided by Tracy every month. If any of that sounds good to you, again, visit patreon.com/functionalnerds. This podcast is copyrighted by the Functional Nerds under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. To learn more about the Functional Nerds, visit functionalnerds.com.